Let's start now with tour two, which explores quarries and farms. As you follow this tour, we'll give directions to the next stop. When you hear this sound, pause the podcast until you arrive at the next stop on the tour. To track your mileage, reset your odometer to zero at the start of each driving tour. Exit the stone bridge, turn right onto Beeman Street, which is also Route 30, that follows the old Pulteney Turnpike. Before this turnpike, the mail post was an uncertain event at best, and travel was no faster than walking. But a syndicate of investors organized to smooth this rough and twisting trail, working with ox-drawn plows and 100-man labor parties. The turnpike secured Pulteney's role as a prosperous transportation center from the 1800s on into the 1840s. At 0.3 miles from the stoplight, pull right into a narrow driveway leading to a brick factory. While brick factories are common in urban areas that were transportation hubs, it's rare to find brick industrial architecture in a rural setting. The Manhattan Shirt Factory marks a transition from 19th century industry, which focused on local raw materials such as slate and dairy, to the 20th century, when factories brought raw materials to process and then mass market to consumers all over the country. The owner of the Manhattan Shirt Company, Henry Spalholz, was also president of the First National Bank and village president. This factory, the company's third, was built here in 1909. Along with Spalholz's own Queen Anne-style home behind the factory, many new houses sprang up on Beeman and Church Streets close to the factory, and other industries clustered along the rail line. Continue driving for another 2 miles. A century before the shirt factory was built, this road was more of a trail and a trial. But with the construction of the turnpike, commerce expanded. Pulteney's location proved to be at a strategic halfway point between Burlington to the north and the Hudson River near Albany to the south. Until the canals and then the railroads were built, this turnpike was the best route for stagecoaches, wagons, and reliable mail service. Local farmers could transport their produce to markets in Albany. Cattle prodders, herding their stock to the markets of Boston, would pause here for the night. This commerce increased the competition between the townspeople of this village, once called West Pulteney and known as a small milling hamlet, and the more prosperous East Pulteney. At mile two, for example, the red brick house on the left operated a distillery, one of 10 in town. It opened around 1815, just after the turnpike did, and distilled rye whiskey for downtown Pulteney and for the taverns up the road at the Farnham Toll House. When you reach Farnham Road, turn left and pause. Today, we think of transportation as a government responsibility. But in the 19th century, it was a private enterprise that helped unite the town's leaders and industrialists in order to benefit the town and themselves. The red brick house on the corner was a tavern, built in 1815, near a toll gate. While the 10-cent toll was collected from those passing through, locals living within 8 miles had their tolls waived, which raised some controversy, as everyone was soon claiming they lived that close. Up the slope, there was a detour over rougher terrain, what was then called a shunpike, that allowed travelers to skip out on the toll. During this turnpike era, Pulteney farmers relied on their cash crops of grain and dairy. One of William Ward's recorded shipments hauled 1,714 pounds of cheese and whiskey to market. The 10-cent toll was only one cost of shipping, in addition to the cost of the wagon, horses, and labor. For instance, when Ward hauled his goods along the turnpikes, some 80 miles to the port near Albany, his account books noted that shipping costs accounted for 37% of the salt and 23% of the whiskey. The cost of maintaining and staffing the turnpikes was not cheap. While the tolls added expense to the many costs of transportation, one toll syndicate reported an annual profit of only $30. In 1823, the completion of the Champlain Canal substantially reduced the profits of the turnpike, and in 1831 it became a public highway. Continue on Farnham Road, which takes us through the center of the Slate Valley, and also past the rail trail, the route of the old rail line known as the Slate Picker. This valley, known for its unique four-colored slate deposits, extends some 24 miles along the New York-Vermont border from Granville, New York, north to Fairhaven, Vermont. The area is about 6 miles wide. When the slate deposits were first discovered, the uses for slate were limited. But in 1848, the roof of a local barn was the first to be covered with slate. While some feared the barn could not withstand the weight, the barn is still standing today with the same slate roof intact. Slate transformed Pulteney in the last half of the 19th century. Turn right at the T on York Street Extension. There's no sign. There are a number of gravel pull-offs on your right, overlooking the quarry pits. Look to your right for a glimpse into the pit of a slate quarry. And on your left, you'll see a dump of slate tailings from one of the many quarries up and down the Slate Valley. With the launch of the slate industry, this farming community, populated mostly by New England Yankees, was transformed into an industrialized town enriched by a diverse group of immigrants, with the largest group of immigrant quarrymen coming from Wales. Listen to what it was like to work here, from Doc Williams, one Pulteney quarryman with a long memory.
I did a lot of different jobs. I drove truck, I cut meat in the store, I worked in a big print shop in Rutland, did a lot of things. But if I got my choice, I'd go quarrying. I did it all. Split and trim, I can cut blocks, I can run air hammer and fire black powder or dynamite.
The slate industry, according to local lore, was launched by accident. Around 1843, a farmer was showing his land to a prospective buyer who kicked at a mound of soil and looked at the rocks he'd dislodged. He exclaimed to the farmer, "Why, that's slate!" And the farmer decided not to sell the land, but to sell the slate. But to get to the good quality slate isn't easy. Doc should know.
Most of the time, the top is no good. Sometimes there's 40, 50, 60 feet that's no good. You take that off and throw it away. That's why these big piles are around here. It's just poor rock. But you go down in and you find the good stuff.
The good stuff, as Doc says, was first used for school slate boards and slate pencils. By the late 1840s, the valley's first quarry was producing 600 school slates per day. Beginning in the 1850s, the industrialization of America supported a home building boom, and builders began to demand slate for their roofs, which last 100 to 150 years if properly maintained. You can see proof of this on many houses throughout the Slate Valley, notably along the streets of Pulteney. Turn left on White Road and look for the weathered wooden building on the left, the old Welsh church. Turn around at a convenient spot. The need for skilled quarry labor prompted the first wave of Welsh immigrants. They had mastered the craft since a similar formation of slate had been quarried in Wales for over 1,000 years. Small company towns such as Farmersville and Blissville developed around the quarries with homes, schools, and churches. The old Welsh church was built in 1871 by the Welsh families who'd congregated here. It's a simple building, ornamented by peaked little boards above the door and window. A new Welsh Presbyterian church was built in Pulteney in 1898 and was a reflection of a population shift into town and away from the little villages and company towns erected near the quarries. Turn right, east, at Saltus Road, then drive through the quarry and pause at the Eureka Quarry headquarters. Here in 1852, the Eagle Quarry opened the first slate pit in Pulteney. Reorganized in 1874, it was renamed the Eureka Quarry and produced a popular roofing slate called Eureka Unfading Green. The Eureka is still quarrying slate today with colors that include purple, green, and sea green. This is one of the many quarries where Doc Williams worked.
That's an old, old quarry. I don't know, 100 and some years that's been running, maybe 140, 150. It's a big hole.
The quarries became their own towns and were almost self-sufficient. Around the Eureka Quarry, the hamlet of Farmersville developed. It had its own blacksmith shop, general store, and post office. Many of these weathered buildings were likely the slate-working shanties. Blocks of slate were blasted loose in the quarry and hauled to the shanties on metal carriages suspended from aerial cables powered by machinery in a cable house. The cables were rigged to a quarry stick raised on top of the slate dump. Each quarry was known for different traits. As Doc notes,
there's all kinds of colors in the valley. North Pulteney is all color up there. There's nothing up there really that fades. It's just good rock. There's a nice unfading green there in a model and a variegated, which is mostly purple with green streaks. Oh, it's pretty, pretty. You'll see it. The high school's got it here, and it lasts forever.
Continue through one of the few dairy farms that remain operational in the Pulteney area. Continue on Saltus Road till you reach a sharp turn with the cemetery on the left. This is one of Pulteney's earliest cemeteries. Here you'll find gravestones from 1781 through 1906 of the Hosford family, the Hookers, and the Lewises, people who lived on nearby lands for generations. Hosford's Crossing Cemetery is also known for the work of two master carvers, William Buckland of Pulteney and Enos Clark of Middletown Springs. Clark carved most of the stones in the front row here and many in the East Pulteney Cemetery. Buckland was one of Pulteney's early settlers who came here as an older man, having made a reputation for himself in Hartford, Connecticut, as a skilled stone carver. His signature style was to give large noses to the faces he engraved. He carved the stone of Thomas Hooker's first and second wives, both named Ruth. It seems the women not only shared the same name and the same husband, but in the end, the same tombstone, known for eternity as Ruth I and Ruth II. William Buckland himself is buried in this cemetery, and fittingly, his stone was carved by Enos Clark, whose initials EC can be seen faintly on the back of the gravestone. Turn right, south, on Highway 30 toward Pulteney, then take your first left on Ward Road, mile 4.7. We're driving into farm country, up Lewis Brook, named for the Lewis family that settled here before the Revolution. This is a landscape shaped by the work and lives of settlers and farmers. These fields and forests typify much of today's Vermont, but during the early settlement days, it was far less wooded. The first settlers grew much of what they needed, with wheat becoming an early cash crop. By the 1820s, the forested Vermont hills were transformed into sheep meadows, with wool exports becoming a key industry and a reason for the loss of 80% of Vermont's forests. After the 1840s, though, wool prices crashed, and a new market emerged for dairy products, served by rail. and new ideas about the value of forests as protection for watersheds led to a slow regeneration of the forest. It was this concern for forested watersheds that led George Perkins Marsh to deliver an address in 1847 to the local agricultural society. Based on this lecture, Marsh wrote Man and Nature, which some consider the first text of the conservation movement. At mile 5.2, look left into the creek bed at the stacked slate wall of an old mill. This was energy on the frontier. The wall once supported a water wheel, one of the few remnants of water-powered mills in a township that once had dozens. This was the north wall of a building from the 1800s, which for more than 50 years was used as a cheese factory and cider mill. Built by Ed Lewis's great-grandfather, it was used until 1895, when he built the cheese factory in East Pulteney. Ed still has the records. The factory was built for $700. His great-grandfather paid himself $2 a day, and his workers from $1 to $1.50. At this T in the road, there's a small wooden building on the left. The distinctive steam vent on the roof marks it as an old sugar house. Closer to the farmhouse and the dairy, there was an ice house. From this temporary storage, farmers had to haul their milk 4 miles to the refrigerated creamery in downtown Pulteney. Ed Lewis remembers how farmers used winter ice and sawdust to keep the milk cool.
Gee, you milk twice a day, and you got to cool your milk at night, and then take it to the creamery in the morning. Most every farm had an ice pond, and they had it because they had to have ice to cool their milk. You cut the blocks about 18 inches square, and as deep the ice was, probably maybe a foot, maybe 2 feet in some winters. And of course you had ice tongs you handled it with, and you put it on the wagons, and it was heavy, very heavy. And you lay a layer of ice in, then a layer of sawdust, then another layer of ice, and another layer of sawdust, so it would keep all summer. Because that's the only way you had to refrigerate your milk. The sawdust kept it insulated so it would stay cold.
Here at the T, we'll direct you to the right on Lewis Road, mile 5.3. But if you have a moment, you might tour to the left on Gorhamtown Road, half a mile, to the Lewis Farm, known as Tidy Hill. The road we're traveling was once the mail route from Castleton to East Pulteney, a route older than the turnpike. Ed Lewis and Doc Williams remember these wagon roads as both their connection to the outside and also their entertainment.
Way back when I was a little kid, they used to deliver by horse. And the wagon is up in the museum, okay? And it used to come up around here and come down the military road right down to our field and come around here. And this was the end of it. And he turned around right there, Paul Wood, when he didn't get stuck. But if he got stuck, you could hear him. think he was a preacher.
Yeah.
But that's how we got. But that's how we got our mail anyway. And one year, it had so much snow that he had a set of skis strapped to his front tires, and he drove that way on a set of skis.
He had a Model T Ford that had a conversion kit. It also had another set of wheels, some of them, on the back, and it run Caterpillar chains.
Yeah.
At mile 6.4, turn right on Hannon Road. Ed tells of a time when slower travels made for good neighbors.
Back then, you had to marry your neighbor because you only had to get anywhere. You had to go afoot or by horse, and you couldn't go over, be away from home very long because you had chores to do. So you had to marry your neighbor, didn't you?
That's about it, yeah.
When you reach the tavern at the Highway 30 junction at mile 7.0, turn left toward Pulteney and return to the stone bridge. Along this stretch of road, there were once 9 farms sending milk to the creamery in Pulteney. Ed used to hitch a ride on the milk truck to the graded school downtown. Pulteney typified the New England character. It was a place shaped by the isolation imposed by long distances and longer winters. Yet, against the cold, a rural society was crafted. Late in his life, Horace Greeley wrote idyllically of the social character that warmed itself around the winter hearth. It was not unusual, Greeley wrote, for family members and friends to make long stays at former homesteads. Friendships were warmer and deeper. Relationship by blood or marriage was more proudly regarded. Men were not ashamed to own that they loved their cousins better than their other neighbors, and their neighbors better than the rest of mankind. You've reached the end of Tour 2. Up next is Tour 3 of Pulteney Village.